Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Psychotherapist and author Richard Hogan is back with us.
Hiya, Brendan. How are you?
Afternoon, Richard. And today we're going to talk about anxiety, Richard. And that's again, right. In the last few days, even we've seen a lot of stuff in the papers about young people, mental health, not getting the services they need, all that kind of thing. Okay, so is there an epidemic of anxiety among young people, or are we just talking it up more?
I think it would be fair to say, an accurate analysis to say, amongst this particular cohort, there is an epidemic of anxiety. It's what, you know, working clinically with it, working in schools, it's a part of their lexicon. That's my anxiety. I mean, I just think it's a huge issue for this particular cohort of students.
The pandemic did a lot of damage.
Massive damage.
I feel we're not talking about it enough like that.
No, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you, because so much of the normative things that you go through as a child and adolescent were denied to this cohort. And so going to the Gaeltacht, you know, going part of clubs, all of that kind of stuff was just denied to them. They didn't do it. And what the teenagers need the most is actually social interaction more than any other phase in their lives. That's when they need that interaction the most, and so that was denied to them. And there's what we're seeing now is the residual. We're seeing the issues of all of those, you know, policies that we brought in there. And I think what we're seeing is young adults really struggling.
You talk about that there are three fear responses in terms of what they went through in the pandemic. Just explain that to me.
Yeah. So just to lay it out for people, fear and anxiety are normative experiences. As humans, that's a normal part of the human condition.
Yeah.
I suppose what drives me mad is that I see in modern mental health, is it reminds me of the diet fad of the 90s. There's a lot of people out there talking about 6-minute abs in the 90s that did a lot of harm for people and different diets. And I can hear the same talk around mental health today about living your life without fear and get rid of anxiety out of your life. And what I'd always say to people, that's like getting on a flight and the captain saying, we have no warning system, but we don't imagine any problems over the Himalayas. You wouldn't get on the flight, right? Yeah. And so we need that response. And that's the first important thing. We all experience it. And so when we experience it, we have generally three responses to it, right?
Okay.
And so the maladaptive responses would be, excuse me, to fear would be control. They look to overly control everything, right? Which is the roots of obsessive thinking, right? Or they have avoidance, which is the roots of phobic behaviour. Okay. Or children can look for incredible amounts of reassurance. And the amount of parents would say to me, it's incredible, Richard, the more reassurance I give him, you know, it's endless. He needs more or she needs more. And so reassurance can implicitly tell your child, I don't believe you have the skills to manage all of this stuff. And so it's really important underneath all of this, Brendan, is the belief or a paradigm you haven't got the skills to manage yourself. Now, that's really crucial understanding for parents. So what's the antidote to anxiety? Developing your child's belief in themselves and their agency and their belief in their competencies that they can manage things. What robs their agency is that when you solve all the problems, when you become the satiating thing, I'd meet parents all the time that say their 15-year-old daughter is sleeping in with them, right? And absolutely. I mean, this would sound very familiar to a lot of parents, that I have to sleep in with her, or I have to talk to her continuously until she falls asleep. And what you're developing there, and psychology is called a positive feedback loop. The thing that they're using to satiate themselves is the thing that's spiraling their lives out of control. And it's like, you know, walking your 5-6-year-old who's, let's say, having issues with going to school, and you're standing at the gate and you're standing there watching them as they go in to see will they turn around. The chances of that child going to school are zero, because the minute they look around, they see you anxiously watching them, they're going to run back out to you. So we have to be very careful of how we respond to our child when they present with a bit of anxiety.
Okay, so there's a lot of things there to maybe break down a little bit. Also, there are texts starting to come in. Maybe in a little while, you're happy to take
absolutely,
text,
yeah.
aren't you? And if you don't have the answer, you'd say you don't have the answer. And if you have an answer, you do. Going back to what you were saying about the culture and everything.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people might think now that there is this labelling of things that went on, that goes on now, that maybe didn't before, right? So you now have anxiety, like,
or it's my OCD,
mental health, all that. Now, nobody's saying that these things are not real for you, but is there a danger? I suppose some people now wonder, is there a danger that we are pathologizing the ups
normative
and downs of life.
Ups and downs of life. I absolutely write about this all the time, Brendan, because I see it so clearly. And I'm in schools so much, and I go to schools giving talks nearly every night of the week. I go all over Ireland talking to schools. And my biggest fear here, and I think what we're creating is a dystopian situation for our children, where we're endorsing mental health issues for them. What we don't want to do ever is go back to the dark ages where none of us spoke about what we experienced, right? None of us are saying that, where we'll go back to the stigma around mental health. But what we need is good resources so that when children experience things, that they have those resources available to them. What we must, you know, if we're to analyse it really, look what's happening. We've never had more talk about mental health, and we've never had more mental health issues, right? And so what's happening in schools is
not necessarily connected, though.
This is what I would say when I look at what's happening in schools. There's, you know, it's okay not to be okay, right? That's a message that's going around schools. If you walk into any school now currently, there's loads of mental health ideas around anxiety and OCD and self-harm and anorexia. You'll see all this literature around, right? And so we are incredibly, and I want to say that twice, so suggestive as a people, right? And this is what I'd often do with teenagers. I tell them in a talk that if you get a pain in your right foot, in your right toe, that could be the start of a heart attack. And I leave them with that for the evening. And in the morning, I say to them, how'd you get on last night? And about three of them out of the class of 20 would say to me, I didn't sleep at all because I had a pain in my bloody toe all night, which what you said to me. I was like, trying to show them that's what happens to us. We're very suggestive. And so if you bring someone into the school system and they're talking about their own experience of self-harm or anxiety or whatever it is there, and they don't have any understanding about what advice to give children, what you're doing is endorsing it. And what's happening, that what's happening is it's becoming almost that it's undesirable not to have it. And that's a really scary position for our children to be in, to have a mental health issue or to have something that stands you out from your, let's say, cohort is desirable. And so we're endorsing it. Let's just say for the weekend that's in it, if Bruce Springsteen came into the school and talked about his anxiety or his depression and left with that, and I admire him, what are the chances of me thinking maybe that's something that I should have? And I've sat with I can't not say this, right? Because I've sat with so many teenagers who said to me, I never thought about self-harming until somebody came into the school and spoke about it. And I tried it that night. And that's what we have to be very careful. It's okay not to be okay. Good message about destigmatizing mental health.
It's okay to be okay.
It's okay to be okay. That's the message that I say is missing. That is really missing amongst children.
And of course we do. We have acknowledged this before because, for example, when people take their own lives, there is a code that you do not discuss the hows and the details or anything because
contagion.
There is a sense that puts that on
it's contagion.
The agenda.
Absolutely.
In some way.
Absolutely. So suggests it to children. It's the most dangerous part of that experience in a school system or in any society is that contagion, that spread, that idea going, you know, permeating somebody's soul. And that's what I'm saying. What I talk about is when you're feeling good, what are you doing? Do more of that. Now, that's not easily monetized.
Okay, okay. Hang on. That's a good one. Before we move on to that, I suppose I should say that, look, a lot of people are going to disagree with you and a lot of people are going to say, it's good that we're talking about all these things. You've acknowledged that.
Yeah.
What you're saying, I sense, is that there is possibly a balance that because we were in one direction where everything was shoved down.
Overcorrection.
Yeah.
And also what I see in schools is sometimes students are in control of the mental health, driving in the school. And so they're bringing in, minor celebrities that they want to meet and talk to, and they mightn't be the best people to talk about mental health, or they mightn't give the best advice around mental health. And so, you know, it's very important if principals and management are listening to this, we have to be very careful who we bring into our system to talk about these really heavy issues, because, you know, as you said there, it can spread ideas around a little cohort that can create a lot of problems.
Okay.
And I see,
a lot of these people are very well intentioned. A lot of them do have
absolutely
qualifications
absolutely,
and everything. You're saying that there's a danger, and I use the term sexy in the broadest.
Absolutely.
That this
that's
stuff
the
has
problem.
Become sexy,
yeah,
kind of.
That's my fear.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to what was that little mantra there? What are you doing when you're feeling good?
Oh, yeah, this is what I say to kids all the time. I said to them, because they're all into football, and I say, if I had, like, say, Brendan Cam, where would I see Brendan having a good time? And they'd say, oh, when I'm with my friends. So I'd say, okay, when you're feeling good, what are you doing? So I'm getting them a little bit more intentional and more aware of, oh yeah, when I'm feeling good, actually I'm with my friends. So I like to be connected to people. And I'd say, well, do more of that now. And when you're feeling bad, let's say, what's going on? I'm probably more isolated. I'm up in my bedroom. I might be playing my game for too many hours. I'm up there playing my game and I'm isolated. Okay, so we need to think about, that's not good for you. That provokes your anxiety and that provokes, you know, negative feelings, dysphoric experiences. Let's pull that out of your life. Let's start to remove that a little bit and bring in the more positive stuff. How easy is that? I mean, that's really simple messaging for children, for all of us.
Yeah, though. And it's something parents can do themselves. Absolutely. Without an intervention or anything.
Without any massive intervention, yeah.
Excuse me. And I suppose what you're touching on there is a kind of an element of positive psychology.
Yeah.
We're not just thinking about fixing the downside. We're
absolutely
thinking about how do you get out of it? The positive side as well. And in a way, the more positive, do you crowd out?
The more positive you crowd out the negative. And so when you're having a low episode, neuroscience would show us that our recall and our memories are more negative. And so the more we're leaning towards positive psychology, the more we change those ideas. And that's really important because we can become easily swamped with negative thoughts and negative ideas about ourselves. And then we can start to isolate ourselves and not go out and start to think about ourselves narrative ways that we're not that strong. We're not that resilient. I can't go out here. I better stay in. And the more we do that, we shrink our lives down. And I meet all the time people who have really shrunk their lives down, Brendan, because they've got issues. A huge word here in all of this is control. And that word will mean a lot to people listening. The desire to control is a terribly negative position that we find ourselves in.
And does this go, I don't want to blame everything on the pandemic, but this goes back to a situation where suddenly, or I remember what Tony Bates called once, our assumptive world was turned on its head.
Absolutely.
And we felt a lack of control even over our own lives. Yeah,
but sure, look at all the concrete ideas that just eroded in a couple of weeks. School was cancelled and you were told to go up into your devices and stay away from your friend. All of those things, like the whole system was out of control. And so what do you do when you feel out of control? You try absolutely everything to control every aspect of your life. And so you start to think ritualistic thoughts, you start to intrusive thoughts, you start to count in twos, you start to tap things, you start to watch your food a bit more. So all of these are, like, you know, negative ways of dealing with the fact that you don't have control.
Okay. And is that a no? Are all those things, because I do meet various parents and people I know, the kids are all playing a variation of that tune, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
But the common thing seems to be is that it's some form of an outworking of the actual anxiety.
Is that absolutely
right? These rituals or these controlled things around eating or whatever, it's all an attempt to
for the perception that you've got control of what you perceive that you've no control over.
Okay.
So if I close the doors, if I check under the bed that there's no killer, this is what I meet all the time. If I check under the bed there's no killer clown, or if I check the corners of the bedroom, if I count in prime numbers, if I go downstairs and check the locks all the time, all of that is a desire to satiate whatever it is that's upsetting you. And what I'd say to people all the time is, it's a key phrase, take control of not having control. That gives you control.
Okay, how do we teach them to do that?
That's such a great question. So when you have a desire to control, I'd say to any parents listening, what do they do? Let's say they think obsessively, or they check everything. And so what you're trying to do now is help your child out of that belief, right? That they need to do this, tap, whatever it is, or, you know, it might even be it could be a movement of the face or anything. So they'll do something like this, you know, just a little twitch in their face to control what they feel is out of control. And so what we have to introduce here is we have to deconstruct that logic.
Okay.
That doesn't actually work. And actually what it's doing is, does that help you, right? I had a client there recently who said to me, she was flying to New York last summer, and on the flight, she kept her feet off the flight for 6.5 hours because she was terrified that if her feet touched the ground, the plane would crash. And I said to her, when the flight arrived into JFK, did they all clap because you saved the flight? And she was like, I know you think I'm mad, Richard, right? And I said, not at all. She said, but no, they didn't. I said, coming back, what did you do? She said, I did the exact same thing. But she said, here's the problem. I'm going to Lanzarote in 4 weeks and I know, you know, I'm terrified I'll do the same thing again. I said, well, you probably should do the same thing again because it seemed to save the flight and nobody died. So it seems like it works, right? And 5 weeks later, she came in to the clinic. She said, I'm cured, right?
Yeah.
So all I did was prove the logic. I gave give her the logic back.
Does the logic work though? Does this become so ingrained that it's immune to logic?
No, it's hyper-rationality. If I do A, B works.
Okay.
If I keep my feet off, you think it's irrational, but if I keep my feet off the ground and the plane doesn't crash, well then the feet off the ground actually save the plane from crashing. That's hyper-rationality in their head. You're going to go,
so we can unpick it in a logical way.
We can. That's when you said to me, what do we do to our children? Help them to unpick it, right? And what I would say to parents all the time is think about your relationship with worry and think about your child's relationship with worry. A very famous story in psychiatry was a famous psychiatrist was going around to different clinics in England studying anxiety. And in one of the clinics, there was a patient clapping her hands, right? And he said to her, why are you clapping your hands? He was doing this true story now, very famous story. And she said, to keep the elephants away. And he said, but there are no elephants in England. And she said, well, you see, it works. Mm. Right? And that's the logic that we apply to control. How do we control things? How does your child, you know, try to manage that control? No. What you need to do is help them out of it, to show them that they don't need that much control and that their desire is actually spiraling them out of control.
Okay, so they're not getting the result.
They're not getting what they want, right? So you're deconstructing that logic for them.
So now you mentioned about parents not helping the kids.
Yeah.
What are they picking up from parents?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So is a lot of this down to like the vibes they pick up in the house, if there's tension in the house or if there seems to be anxiety?
Well, huge research and all of that, like obviously, and yes, absolutely. And I meet it all the time, Brendan. And I only had a client recently who came in to describe his daughter to me. And there was heavy, these kind of sighs in the conversation about his anxious daughter, right? And when I met the daughter a week later, the only remarkable thing about the conversation was her heavy sighs, right? And so with modelling, it's such an important part of how we develop a framework for how we perceive the world and how our parents are. This is not to freak parents out, but how you are.
It's not what we're telling them.
Yeah, is going to be the template by which your child begins to kind of perceive themselves. And so when they come to you with anxiety, the key thing is that you don't get anxious. You know,
this is it.
That's it. The key thing is you've got to watch your response to your child's anxiety. And this is what I meet all the time. And I have to say this to parents. Don't make anxiety such a big thing. You know, when your child comes to you at an anxious moment, do not give it such power, because I meet it as a therapist and I use narrative techniques to unravel it. And I would interview the anxiety and I'd often ask the anxiety, you know, what does Brendan need to do to remove you and to make you less loud? And the anxiety would say, Brendan doesn't want to get rid of me. I give Brendan incredible power in this family. They're all oriented around me. And it's like, you got to be careful of that. What I'd say to parents is like, you know, you could dedicate maybe 5 minutes to asking your child about, well, you know, and have that set time, but it's not everything. It doesn't become this monster in the house that's dominating everything and infiltrating into the other kids. Then the other kids see, geez, this thing has huge power. And it's like, no, you got to remove that idea from the family.
And in terms of what we used to call like worrying, and a kid is a worrier, is that anxiety, or have we changed that into anxiety, or have we kind of made it more permanent by calling it anxiety?
Well, yeah, when it's more protracted and more prolonged, you'd say it's anxiety. But a lot of it, what I'd say in teenage lexicon, let's say, when they said, that's my anxiety, a lot of that would just be worry. You know, I'd have students who'd say to me, it's my anxiety last night because I was really struggling to sleep because of the exam. I'd say, that's not anxiety, that's just normative worry that we all have. And if you look at anybody like Usain Bolt or Nadal or anybody who's had a high level, they go through all that kind of stuff, you know, before a massive race. That's just normal.
You need to be telling them this is normal.
That's
worry is a part of life.
Such an important message, because the messaging on TikTok is get rid of worry, anxiety, this and fear that. And it's like, no, these are normative experiences of the human condition. And so the more we relax about it and expect it to happen, when it pops in, we don't, you know, collapse under it.
Okay, just let's take a time out for a second and look at some texts here. A lot of them are from teachers, right?
Yeah.
As a secondary school teacher, students seem mad to label every behaviour now. It's everywhere, to be fair. Acceptance of emotions and management of situations is obviously vital. I'm trying to promote fitness and a feel healthy, think healthy kind of vibe. Promoting positive management of emotion is not the way to go, Rory.
Absolutely.
Says. That sounds sensible, doesn't it?
That's really sensible and healthy, Rory.
Yeah. Christina, the mental health topic gets too much attention from most people. We all need to get on with it and see the positive side of life. Respect of nature, support family and love, so important. Social media needs to be more restrictive. Good point. Thank you for saying it's okay to feel okay. As an early years educator over many years, I'm seeing more and more parents looking for problems in their children rather than looking to see the positive. Are you seeing that? Are parents looking for problems? Yeah,
I see parents with the unrealistic expectation that their children should never experience a low period in their lives, you know, and they're trying to shield them from. And it comes out of, as we said, well-intentioned and, you know, the desire to love your, you know, to help your children. But they have to experience these things. What's the antidote to all this, Brendan, is believing you have competency. What gives you competency? An exposure to the thing. What's the biggest cure for anxiety? Exposure to it. I work with this all the time where...
Give me an example.
I had a kid who fainted in class, right? And as a result of that fear, he started not going to school. Brilliant student. And they came to me, the family came to me and said, what are we going to do here? He hasn't gone to school for weeks. And I said, okay, what's happening? And they said, well, we drive him to school and we pull up around the back of the school and then he doesn't get out of the car. And I was like, well, is that the way you normally do it? And they said, no, normally he walks to school. I said, okay, let's incrementally dismantle this thing. I said, so you drive to the school, you don't pause, you drive off, you get out. Do that for a week and let's see. It's going to be painful. I said, but let's do it. So he came back next week. He said, yeah, that was painful, awful, but I did it. And I said, how did you feel after about 20 minutes? Perfect, felt grand again. So you know now, you've got data to know, 20 minutes, this thing is gone. And he's like, yeah. So I said, no, next week I want you to walk to school. And I want you to come back into the clinic and tell me what you're feeling. And he came back and it was awful for the walk in. It felt knots in my stomach. And it, after 15, 10 minutes, it was gone. And so we just slowly dismantled it. And the mom sent me a lovely email telling me that, like, you know, he's perfect. Did his junior cert. Everything's fine. He's back to the normal kid he once was, right? Another quick one out there is that I had a student come up to me one time and said to me, well, recently enough, please don't ask me to read in front of the class. I have anxiety. And I get this quite often. And I don't align with it, right? I hear it and I say, oh yeah, sure, yeah, I'll do my best. I said, yeah, but I might forget. So I caveat with them because I know what I'm going to do here. I say, I might forget. And so what I'll do is ask them a question to speak out loud. And I can hear their, as they're talking in the class, I can hear the bit of anxiety. And then I ask them again a week later and I can hear the anxiety less. And then I might ask them to read a little line out for me, just a small thing. And so what I'm doing is dismantling the logic. I can actually read out loud in class. I can actually manage myself. And if I aligned with them, or if the parents align with them and say, you don't have to go to school today because you feel anxious, what you're doing is creating one of the biggest binds that you can ever get yourself into as a parent, which is a positive feedback loop. The thing that you're allowing your child to do, which satiates it in the immediate, creates massive problems going forward. And the image I always give, this is the analogy I use, it's like when I say to kids, and they love this image, and I've heard so many teenagers say to me, geez, that really helped me. I'd say, you know, when you cut your leg, and your leg starts to heal and the scab starts to form. And they're like, yeah. I say, you know, you have a desire there to itchy that, don't you? And they're like, oh yeah, Jesus, yeah. I say, well, what do you do with that dilemma? And they'd say, well, I don't itch you because the scab, it will go away quickly. And I said, but if you did itch you, what happens? It would feel good in the immediate, but go deeper. And the scab will have to reform and then you itch it again and back on and on. And you go to square one. So avoidance is square one. You know, getting aligned in with your child and agreeing with them that they are an anxious child. That's all that kind of itching the scab, you know. And we have to be very careful how we manage ourselves.
So we all have to do this a little bit.
Yeah.
Push ourselves out there a little bit in ways that are uncomfortable.
Discomfort.
The kids not going to school...
Huge.
Yeah. Now, am I right in thinking, this wasn't such a big thing before, but has it suddenly become a massive issue?
A huge part of it, Brendan, is, and I don't think anyone talks about it, is technology. Right before, school refusal was about refusing school, the curriculum, all that kind of stuff. Right, in today's phenomenon of school refusal, it's two things. I think a bit of this is the pandemic, you know, the disruption to school and that kind of structure. Right, but that's definitely present. I think in this cohort of children, they have a fear about being adults that never was present before. Right. But also staying up late at night on their devices. If you sat in my clinic, honestly, you'd hear the stories of families.
I gather a lot of the boys are just locked in the room, no gaming all the time and have no great interest in coming out again.
Not too much now. Right.
Yeah.
And then the girls are on their Instagram and their TikTok and their Snapchat and they have streaks. Right. And so to break your streak makes you kind of, you know, someone would say, oh, you didn't text back at 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, you must have been asleep. And so they're staying up much later, and so that what we find now with school refusal, massive sleep deprivation. So it's not about the curriculum as much; it's about actually being tired.
Listen, on social media, there's a question here. My 13-year-old daughter was bullied in primary school. Mm. My husband and I dealt with it by enabling her to use any language exactly. she needed to use to defend herself. I informed the school of this also. She never used it. Now in first year, she won't go to discos. She isn't on any social media forum. She's in a hyper-vigilant state. You see, that's I think it. Of anxiety, the fire alarm going yeah. off all the time. Isn't it? However, she's also confident, funny and self-assured. My question is, will she eventually come out of self-protection mode?
She will. And here's the thing, right? And that's a very good example of what goes on for a lot of people. And what you're saying there is that the brain is in a hyper-vigilant, hyper-alerted state. And so information from the amygdala in the middle of the brain here doesn't go up into the prefrontal cortex, right? The analysis, the rational part. And so what happens, they stay down alert. And so your daughter is protecting herself. This is the positive feedback loop now. You have to break it. She believes that staying in and not going out protects her from potential bullying, which is a very unfortunate experience that she had. She shouldn't have had that. But you have to help her to see that that is not protective. That's harming her. And so the more she can go out and the more exposure she gets to going out, she started to reauthor the story that I don't need this guard around me, I don't need this protective thing around me, I can actually manage myself, I have agency. These are all really important ideas. So it's like slow, not too much at the beginning, slow exposure, slow going out, slow meeting people, you know, new friends coming in, obviously college and all that stuff will be a new landscape. All of that will help her to reauthor who she is. But currently she's got a negative belief about herself that she can't manage herself out there. And what you have to help her to see is that that's actually a distortion in your thinking. You can manage yourself out there, and you're this guard that you have around you isn't protecting you, it's actually damaging you.
Okay. I think the ultimate lesson we're getting there is that sometimes the ways we think we're protecting them and minding them are probably
the opposite. Damaging,
yeah. And the other lesson I'm getting from these texts is I feel very sorry for a lot of teachers there who are trying to negotiate all this.
Yeah.
Richard Hogan, thanks, excellent Brendan. As always. Thank you very much. We'll take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.